This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the 7th annual holiday WESU Pledge Drive is here, and we're here as well. And we hope everybody who's listening will give us a call and join in on this special week that we have, trying to raise $10,000 over the next few days. So we need your participation.
And we don't do this very often, but we do need your support. We depend on non-commercial college and community radio to bring us this incredible variety of music and talk shows that WESU brings you every week. And it's a chance to say thanks to this wonderful community and the Wesleyan University students who volunteer their time to bring you these shows. And Mark, I learned something new, that WESU is the longest running college radio station in the United States.
And they still look good. WESU also has been very good to us. They've hosted Conversations on Healthcare for over the past 2 years, and we can't thank them enough. Hopefully you'll join us in with a special thank you, and you'll get online right now at WESUFM.org or call us at 860-685-7700.
That's right. They make our shows possible with interviews with important guests like the United States' first Chief Technology Officer, Anish Chopra. And we've got an interview coming up with Anish Chopra today. There's also important news out there about the court challenge to the Affordable Care Act, the latest court challenge, I should say, as well as a look at how healthcare reform is affecting senior citizens.
You know, the radio ban is narrowing, and too many college radio stations have been cash-strapped in these times. They've sold off their airwaves, but not here at WESU. We continue to be a creative voice and vehicle for social change, and we're excited to be here in the greater Connecticut Valley, and we hope everybody who's listening to us will give us a call or at 860-685-7700 or get online at WESUFM.org and make your pledge today.
And we know many of our listeners tune in from all around the country, but you know, radio, like healthcare, is all local as well as national. And WESU is such an important service to the university and to the Central Valley of Connecticut, and now a good ways beyond, because last year WESU quadrupled its broadcasting power from 1,500 watts to 6,000 watts. That doubled the potential listening audience throughout the Connecticut and Southern New England region. Your support during this holiday pledge drive ensures that WESU continues to beam those airwaves.
So give us a call right now at 860-685-7700. Get online at WESUFM.org. You know, if you make a pledge of $40, WESU will give you a WESU long sleeve shirt. Margaret, I think you gave one of those away last year.
He's getting another one.
He's getting another one. He'll enjoy it. And your choice of a pledge for $50, you'll get a $25 coupon from Middletown Framing, or for a grand prize of $100, you'll get up to 3 hours of studio recording time. What's the story about that studio recording time?
Well, you know, Middletown is such an eclectic community. We have the Coffee House Recording Studio, and they're offering 3 hours of recording time and a CD. So for those of you who have a creative genius in your life looking for some recorded expression, that's the one.
So get online right now and make your pledge at WESUFM.org or give us a call at 860-685-7700. You know, it's hard to remember those numbers when you're driving and trying to put it in your iPhone. So pull over and get this number one more time, 860-685-7700.
And when you've taken care of that, enjoy today's show, because we are very excited to welcome the United States' first Chief Technology Officer, Anish Chopra, to the show today.
We're very happy that he can join us. And no matter what the story, you can always find out more about our shows, you hear about us, by Googling CHC Radio. And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Anish Chopra, the United States Chief Technology Officer. Welcome, Anish, and thank you for joining us today. You serve as the country's first Chief Technology Officer. In that role, you serve as the Assistant to the President and the Associate Director for Technology within the Office of Science and Technology Policy. What a great perch, but you have a waterfront of responsibilities and opportunities, including fostering new ideas and encouraging government-wide coordination to help the country meet its key goals, like reducing healthcare costs and improving patient outcomes. So a big picture question, what do you see as the most important healthcare technology issue that our country is facing right now?
Well, to me, the most important healthcare technology issue is actually quite separate from technology in its traditional sense. It's the business models under which technologies can both be surfaced and scaled. So the challenge before us is to move the healthcare industry from one that focuses on paying for volume of care to one that pays for health and value. And that transition creates market opportunities that I believe will bring new technologies to market that today find a difficult time achieving a business model.
So the this administration has certainly made the advancement of technology in healthcare, as Mark said, but also in areas from homeland security to the environment, a priority. And we appreciate that you've also made the point that you're working to democratize government by liberating the data that it collects, which is a great thing. But right now, the priority certainly in Washington is jobs, jobs, and jobs. How do you see your work as the chief technology officer as contributing to that goal, to generating new jobs, particularly in healthcare technology? Where will these jobs come from, and what are we doing to prepare young people to hold those jobs?
So there are basically three areas where we see job creation, job growth associated with the president's innovation strategy. The first point is that we need an infrastructure or foundation of healthcare IT that could then form the basis of the products and services to change the care delivery system. That infrastructure, if you stripped it down to its core essentials, it's not just the software that powers the physicians' offices and hospitals, but it is the communications infrastructure on which it sits. So the president has called for an ambitious $10 billion initiative to modernize the nation's wireless infrastructure with emphasis on how it can help our first responders. It would include EMS technicians, besides a set of other policies meant to spur private capital investment in the next generation of mobile broadband. That infrastructure layer, we believe, will generate good-paying, hard-working American jobs around installing cable, layering, facilitating the construction of towers and communications infrastructure, all the way up to the installation of healthcare IT software and services, which, as you saw as recently as earlier this week, the USA Today article referencing the job creation and income growth to all of the companies that are in that health IT sector. So that's the first layer. The second layer is this notion of getting the rules of the road right in an internet-based economy. So how do we ensure privacy and security? If we get the rules right, we will foster an incredible list of new companies, new products, new services that understand the rules of the road and can compete effectively, small to big, it doesn't matter the size of the company. But we've got to get the rules right. So we've put forward a set of internet policy principles that should guide our rulemaking activities so that we can foster innovation while protecting the American people at the same time. Getting that right is another key element in getting new companies off the ground, which in turn means new jobs. And last but certainly not least, the president articulated a vision of open innovation, and that is for the specific challenges at hand, as I mentioned earlier, shifting the payment system to focus on value over volume. That implies a set of new products and services largely built on this new digital infrastructure that actually can hit the market and can scale. So the presumption is there will be an industry born tomorrow that's just having its early signs of life today that will all be focused on ensuring that doctors and hospitals have the information, support tools, and services they need to keep us healthy. If the ambition is to reduce readmission rates, ensure that a patient is taking their meds, is complying with the regimen their doctor had established for them, if adherence is an issue, those goals, which achieve a value-based healthcare system, will, I believe, create new market opportunities that will create the Googles of the 21st century healthcare and delivery system that could effectively grow up to be billion-dollar companies. So that is something we see very, very much in the horizon.
You know, I know you're working in Washington, D.C., but you've brought a Silicon Valley startup feel to your work. You're very focused in on outcomes. You talk oftentimes about 90-day turnarounds, very refreshing. And one of the many initiatives you're leading is called Startup America, which launched this past January. Tell us about this initiative and what you're doing to close the health gap between entrepreneurs, corporations, universities, and other stakeholders with this initiative.
Well, thank you for bringing it up. The president, you know, reminds us that the role of government is not just passing laws and organizing budgets, but often it's the leadership qualities of calling Americans into action. Earlier in 2010, President Obama, when signing the small business bill, called on the broader American community, the entrepreneurial and innovation community more specifically, on finding ways to increase the success rate of high-growth entrepreneurs. That call to arms led a number of stakeholders without any taxpayer funds to come together and form a nonprofit organization called the Startup America Partnership, led by Steve Case at AOL and a number of other thought leaders. They then have gone on a organizing rallying cry around the country and have amalgamated over $700 million of private sector resources aimed at their ambitious goal to help 100,000 high-growth entrepreneurs scale across the next several years. That ambitious agenda does link up to our role in government because they provide a terrific input source on the regulatory barriers that need reviewing, on opportunities to leverage research and development to bring lab innovations to market, and to encourage through our supply chain the purchasing of new products and services. You can see this in the VA, for example. We've opened up our innovation-related procurements, so now startups like American Well, which is one of the leading telemedicine companies, mm-hmm. is now on a pilot initiative in the VA, something that the CEO told me was laughable when I first mentioned the idea that he should compete for the innovation program because he wasn't familiar with government bureaucracy, applying for a contract, and all the hassles. This program made it very easy for high-growth companies to bring their best ideas to advance the state of affairs for the nation's heroes, our veteran community. So we're using all of our tools in Washington synced up with this private sector call to arms, and what we're seeing is now a grassroots movement. I just was in Boulder, Colorado, where they launched Startup Colorado, a locally organized community to foster that kind of new product development activity. And what's amazing is one of their key priorities in Boulder was looking at healthcare as a vertical. So in that particular example, we provided an initiative called DC to VC, where myself, Todd Park, and a number of other stakeholders in the administration have reached out to entrepreneurs and innovators, investors, and the like to share with them the truth about where we are in policy and the market environment that exists that they then could engage in so that their innovative new products can scale. And that's how we leverage Startup America.
And, you know, I think exactly what you describe is a part of what the American public is very hungry to hear about. And that's the results of these investments and innovations that we're making. And when we look at the priorities around reducing healthcare costs, but improving quality and improving health outcomes at the same time, I think we have, dare I say, bipartisan agreement that those are worthy goals. And we've talked many times on the show about how electronic health records and health information exchanges, mobile health technology, all of these things can have an impact on that triple aim. But tell me this, what are you watching to see what the impact is to date? Because we're not hearing a lot about that coming back out. And, you know, it's maybe not fully mature, but certainly there's been enormous progress, I would say, in the last 5 to 7 years around the implementation of these technologies, around moving to electronic prescribing, around things that really should be driving quality and cost. And I know you all are very driven at HHS and in the White House. So what are you keeping an eye on to see if the needle is really changing in the right direction?
Well, this is one of the most important questions. That's why when we, in the Recovery Act, developed our $20-plus billion program to incentivize physicians and hospitals around the adoption of electronic health records, why the two most important words were added. The words were meaningful use. That meant it was no longer sufficient that you'd walk over to an equivalent of a Best Buy, grab a box of software, hand us the receipt and say, see, I got my technology, now give me my check, which is, if you hadn't used the words meaningful use, you would essentially describe an adoption campaign, which is to prove that you've purchased something, not that you've put it to use to change the care delivery system. By adding the words meaningful use, we're now engineered to look at outcomes measures. So, for example, the President's Federal Advisory Committee that is informing us as to what should constitute meaningful use is asking a very basic question. Are patients achieving or being offered an electronic copy of their own healthcare data? That had never been a feature set traditionally in electronic health record software. So it was mind-boggling that that had never been a quote-unquote requirement since no one had asked for it. But now we're saying, no, it's very much part of our philosophy and vision that you're not going to see the innovations in the healthcare delivery system unless data moves. And from a privacy and security standpoint, the most powerful thing you can do is empower the individual. There are no privacy constraints on providing data to the individual themselves. So we've now made that a requirement. And so one way to measure is, are people actually getting their healthcare data? In the VA, thanks to Blue Button and other tools to make that easy, over 500,000 Americans are downloading their own healthcare data in the VA alone, plus the DOD and Medicare. So that is an example where the meaningful use requirement and the subsequent market reaction is demonstrating results. The more important issue, obviously, is on quality. And as we move to the second stage of meaningful use and we move to the third stage in the coming years, we are ratcheting up the quality measures. And you're already seeing this in the study that Cleveland Clinic published just a few months back, where they evaluated the quality of care for diabetic patients on a base of 27,000 patients in the Cleveland area. And to cut the long story short, they found that doctors in a paper-based environment only delivered 7% of the recommended care interventions, whereas those on electronic systems delivered at 51%. And actually, when you talk to the team in Cleveland that did the research, they'll tell you anecdotally, the more quote-unquote meaningful use associated with the, that is, more alerts and reminders and more sophisticated decision support tools, the higher that rate even went still. So we're starting to see evidence on the quality side and on the more fundamental elements of making sure data is moving, which could then be the rocket fuel for the products and services that we think will emerge in the coming years.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Anish Chopra, the United States Chief Technology Officer. You mentioned a minute ago one of your partners in technology, Todd Parks, who's the Chief Technology Officer at HHS. And you're both notorious for your animated, engaging conversations about open government and unleashing data. What is open government and what does it mean to unleash data, especially for patients and innovators, as well as the system is focused in on trying to get good outcomes and saving money?
At its core, the President of the United States firmly believes and took action on his first day in office that expertise in our society is widely dispersed, and that if we're to succeed, in his words, win the future, we have to tap into that expertise from all across the country to solve the big challenges of our day. And so he directed us to put in place the systems so that the American people have a government that invites their active participation. So on his first full day, he directed me to develop a set of recommendations that we've now turned into an initiative called the Open Government Directive and the Open Government Initiative. And the philosophy is that the default setting for the American taxpayers, we've told them, you've paid for information, we will provide you access to it, that we want to hear your voice in new and creative ways, so we will allow you to participate in your government in ways you've never imagined before. A primary care doctor, by the way, was the genesis of the Direct Project, which was all about safe, secure email. It wasn't some lobbyist in some secret room who did it. It was a regular doctor.
Right.
And lastly, the notion that if we were to look out into the future, and I hate to use this term because it's so pedantic at this point, but this apps economy reflects the opportunity to deliver breakthrough products and services in sectors that have not seen the kind of transformation you'd like: health, energy, education. Data is the rocket fuel, the active ingredient that powers an apps economy. And I got to tell you, we in Washington have lots of it. We have regulatory authority over lots more. And we have convening power to encourage even more to be made available so that if we truly believe we're going to see breakthroughs in care delivery, it will inevitably mean that there are products and services that are on the market tomorrow that have not been in use today. And those products and services, mark my words, will incorporate data either surfaced from the government, nudged out by our regulatory tools, or convened out of a private-public collaboration to get that information to the hands of innovators and entrepreneurs.
Well, you've also got a great command of language, and the phrases like unleashing data are very powerful in their sense of energy and what is coming at us. And sort of in that same vein, I think you've tried to really unleash the power of social media as well to be an effective tool for government. You certainly are an expert user yourself. I know I follow you on Twitter. And we often say, and you tweet quite a bit, we often say that each state is a potential laboratory for innovation. And when you were in Virginia, you were known for some innovations such as Ning to communicate with rural providers. Tell us about how you've used social media in Virginia, how you're using it in Washington, and what do you see of the power of this media to also improve health and health care for Americans?
We ran an innovation fund. The governor had reserved about $3 million that we allowed agencies to apply for if they had a business problem that they needed to solve and they thought there was a technological innovation that could address it. Well, God bless the commissioner. She had the idea, could we leverage social networking in order to find a way to connect those folks in the rural parts of the state who don't want to travel to Richmond as to be a part of the dialogue on what's wrong and what we can do to solve the infant mortality problem. I picked up the phone and I called Ning and a bunch of other social networks and they said, we'll waive all our fees. We'd be happy to do this as a collaboration. And boom, the next thing you know, we had a network set up and the physician community as well as the nurses and the health department all were able to set up profiles and engage and communicate. So it wasn't that we used the technology like a social network and that was the answer to the problem. It's that we had a specific issue. We went after it, and we saw when you combine a problem and you have tools to solve it in new and creative ways, magic happens. And this is something the president announced just 10 days ago when we launched the Veterans Job Bank. You know, he asked the American people and employers, can you, all these Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are coming home and they have a higher rate of unemployment than the broader population. What can we do to ensure that we give those folks a chance? So he asked the private sector, will you commit to hiring 100,000 veterans over the next 2 years or 3 years? And they responded in droves and said, my goodness, we would be delighted. And here's the problem. How will a veteran find a job posting made available by the veteran community, by these employers? So rather than have some big, massive government IT project with like a database that everybody had to deposit jobs into, we used the social web. And we facilitated a very open standard, a schema that it was called the job posting schema that Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo all agreed through under their schema.org collaboration that said any job that's published to the web that includes this schema can mark up the fact that it's associated with a veteran hiring commitment. Wherever you are on the web, if you like to publish your job listings on Monster, bless you. You want to do it yourself on your corporate HR site, bless you. And today, we have nearly 1 million jobs that the private sector has voluntarily tagged in order to support the discoverability of those job listings by veterans looking to find them. And that kind of lightweight, no-cost, simple approach is why we can accomplish, I hope, modest, but hopefully better, products and services for the American people in these 90-day increments. And that's the power of social media. That's the power of the social web. You're building on a very robust infrastructure. And that's really exciting.
Today, we've been speaking with Anish Chopra, the United States Chief Technology Officer. Thank you so much for joining us today. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea highlights a food financing initiative in California that's building healthy and economically stable communities.
Really central to our mission to provide access to quality care for underserved individuals is the issue of obesity and addressing diet-related diseases. And clearly, having access to healthy food is critical in addressing the issue of diabetes, heart disease, and other diet-related diseases.
The California Fresh Works Fund is a public-private partnership that provides incentives for food retailers to open up shops in food deserts. These are areas mainly in low-income communities of color where residents have little to no access to grocery stores and fresh, healthy foods. But the scarcity of food retailers goes beyond health. Poor communities are cut off from the economic development opportunities that arise from a local grocery store, like the creation of jobs, the attraction of other small businesses, and the support of surrounding residential real estate values. The Fresh Work Funds provide loans and grants to healthy food retailers and distributors willing to locate in these food deserts around California. So far, investors have joined to provide $221 million in the fund. And Fresh Work says new stores are expected to create and retain around 6,000 jobs in California. A scalable model that addresses the problem of food deserts and improves health, sparks economic development, and helps transform underserved communities. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.